Hello everyone and welcome to episode 5 of the Investigate Europe podcast. My name is Sindhuri Nandakumar and this is a show where my co-host Oliver Moldenhauer and I speak with our journalists about the work that they're doing. Right now we're in early 2021 and today's episode is very timely because we're going to be speaking about vaccine nationalism. So last year, soon after the COVID-19 pandemic struck, our team at Investigate Europe pivoted and decided to launch a new investigation about the role of politics and states in the rush to find a cure for COVID. These were really early days and all the vaccines were still under development, but our journalists looked at the distribution and procurement schemes for the time when that vaccine would actually be ready. And they've followed the issue ever since. And today, as people all over the world have started to get vaccinated, we're going to take a look at what our investigation revealed and how the reality has actually unfolded. So for that, I'm pleased to welcome our guest for today, who is Ingeborg Eliasson. She is a founding member of Investigate Europe and a journalist based in Norway. And she comes with decades of experience and has worked as a correspondent in Brussels and Washington, D.C., and is the author of a number of books on a range of topics, including universal basic income, security, and the labor market. Ingeborg, it's great to have you here and welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Sindhu. It's great to be here.
Okay, so firstly, I have to ask you, what is vaccine nationalism?
That would be the mechanism where every government would make sure it gets the vaccines that it needs for its citizens. And it's a very, very common and instinctive mechanism in these issues.
Right. Okay. So it's kind of a way of placing your citizens above others, would you say?
Definitely. And the thing is that it's also not really to be criticized from the starting point, because in most, well, any democratic country, our politicians are elected to take care of their citizens. This is their ultimate priority, to make sure there is life and health for the citizens. So this is not a strange thing. It's just that it results in very grotesque situations when it is practiced.
And that's kind of, you've outlined a lot of that in your investigation, but I'm curious to know, if we rewind a little bit, when Investigate Europe launched this vaccine investigation last year in May, what were you setting to find out and what did you actually end up discovering?
It's a market-driven thing, vaccines and medication. Vaccines could have been not so market-driven, but it could have been seen as utilities as it used to be before. Something so basic that states would have the responsibility to take care of it and provide it. As it is now, it is a market. And that means that those who can buy, who have money to buy for, and who are maybe enough people in the market to be interesting to the companies that sell, would get ahead of those countries who either are too small to be significant enough to be interesting, or who don't have money to pay. All in all, this gets very ugly when we are talking about one vaccine that everybody needs at the same time. That is not very often. But this is the case. Everybody wants the same vaccine and there's not enough to go around.
You've also delved into the initiatives that have been set up to counter exactly those. And what are some of these initiatives that actually help ensure more fairness in distribution?
There are some initiatives. Some of them are quite old. Some of them are newer. One of them is the Vaccine Alliance Gavi, American base, that have seen to it that hundreds of thousands or millions of children have been vaccinated that otherwise might not have been. And there is the initiative called CEPI, which is coalition to make sure that those ugly side effects of the market system that some people actually never get to get vaccines is covered by other means. And these two organizations have also become very, very important now in some quite historical and unique initiatives to actually get vaccines to everyone against COVID. Those two organizations have, together with the World Health Organization, established something called COVAX, which is an initiative to have one purchasing agent for the whole world. You know, like one point one mechanism to negotiate purchases of vaccine and to distribute them for the whole world. That sounds almost too good to be true, and it is. Although over 90 countries have signed up for this to get vaccines through this COVAX, and although rich countries have kind of applauded this, they have not also taken the chance that COVAX would buy vaccines for them, the rich countries. So they prefer to buy for themselves, which means that when there's not enough to go around, the rich would still get the first vaccines. So COVAX has been grossly underfunded, although everyone kind of applauds it. Hopefully that will change now, but it still means that people in Europe and probably the US and Canada and other rich countries will be vaccinated much before most populations in the global south. There is one that is a tad more radical than the COVAX thing. It's called CTAP. It's patent pool, meaning mechanism where companies, pharma companies, on a voluntary basis can decide to share their intellectual property rights and know-how so that anyone who can produce vaccines can do it. This is also something that's applauded by many countries, including rich countries, but they don't seem to do much more than that to make it happen. And no pharmaceutical company so far has joined this initiative. So it's really, it looks kind of dead in the water. And then in the end, there is this very interesting initiative by South Africa and India and some other countries to suspend all intellectual property rights in the pandemic and to make this vaccine a people's vaccine so that anyone, anywhere that is able to produce it can do so without having to think of how much it would cost or if they have the rights to do it. This is heavily opposed by the Western countries that have a pharmaceutical industry. But there's an alliance of countries in the global south and consumer groups in Europe and aid groups like Doctors Without Borders that think in along these lines.
Ingeborg, there's a couple of things I want to unpack here. With COVAX, is my understanding correct in that rich countries who are a part of it are also then going ahead and procuring vaccines on their own? So it's kind of like an insurance policy, and no matter what, they're going to have doses for their own citizens.
Yes, I think this is fair to say. They have given money to COVAX, and they have been offered to buy their vaccines through COVAX. But as it is, they preferred to go it alone, meaning either for each nation, but in the European case, as EU together. So they would, for them, COVAX would look more like an aid project than actually we are doing it together.
And then the other effort led by South Africa and India in the World Trade Organization that you mentioned, asking for the suspension of intellectual property rights related to COVID-19. It's interesting that, it's been blocked by the EU and Norway. Can you take us behind the psychology of this decision? Is it purely led by pharmaceutical interests, or is there another reason? What are these countries saying when they block this proposal?
As you mentioned, it looks like it's the countries, the regions that have pharmaceutical industry that is against this changing of the rules. So that's interests and explanations in that. For Norway, which does not have vaccine production anymore, the attitude is that you don't change the rules in the middle of this emergency. It is kind of deviation from what needs to happen now, which is to find practical ways of getting vaccines to everyone who needs them and not get stuck in what some see as a symbolic act, which would not lead to more vaccines, in fact, but would lead to very, very deeply rooted ideological discussions that would not have an immediate solution, that actually you would lose a lot of time doing this. The counter argument, of course, is if the rules should not be put on hold this time, then when should they, and when should this happen?
And I'm interested to find out your views as a journalist who's studied this extensively and looked at the data. Do you think the argument that this is an ideological move that won't lead to more vaccines is actually correct?
I would say I don't know. You know, this is, there are qualified people saying things, opposite things on each side there. So I really don't know. This is right now, production capacity is a very, very big issue. And one of the reasons why countries seem to be fighting, and even within the EU, there has been controversies around this, is that the companies have not been able to produce as much as is needed, and even not as much as they thought they would. But whether or not suspension of the rules right now would lead to lots of vaccination facilities popping up ready to do it, I don't know.
Ingeborg, what can we learn from past experiences with the distribution of vaccines and other, you know, epidemics and pandemics, for example?
We can learn that vaccines are usually not profitable enough to be a priority to develop for the industry. It usually takes many years, 8 to 10 to 15 years. Most of the vaccine candidates that are tried fail. And then there's often lack of markets. So there's not much incentive to do that, to actually develop without public funding. And the pandemic, of course, changes all this. There is definitely a huge market. And the vaccine didn't exist. It had to be found and states through zillions of money on it. This is one thing to learn. And then, of course, all the instinctive nationalism that comes into play. And therefore, the question in the pandemic is kind of, what is the smartest way to protect your population? What is the most civilized way? Is it, can you really fight the virus if you fight each other? Is the smart way to cooperate or to compete? And I'd argue that Europe, although there's lots of things to complain about, broke with the past in the pandemic because they have negotiated as one vis-a-vis the industry, instead of Norway doing it for them, Belgium do it for them, and Germany doing it for them.
And what does that bring to the table? Is it a stronger negotiating power? Is it a use of greater resources? What are the advantages of having this single negotiating mechanism?
Exactly what you said. Of course, when you negotiate on behalf of 500 million people and you negotiate simultaneously with a handful or even more companies who don't know what happens in the other negotiations, of course, you are a strong arm. And you can see it on the conditions of the purchasing contracts are not available usually, but now there have been leaks on different contracts, different places. And it seems that the EU has, for instance, in the AstraZeneca vaccine, negotiated a very, very good price. And astonishingly, a much, much better price than, for instance, South Africa, that seems to have to pay 2.5 times what the European Union has to pay for the same vaccine, and Uganda that has to pay even more than that.
And since you mentioned AstraZeneca, I want to kind of talk about this public spat that the EU and the pharma company had. Can you talk a bit about what happened and what are the lessons here, or what are the big takeaways in terms of vaccine procurement?
So AstraZeneca was, from what we know, the cheapest of the vaccines that the EU bought, negotiated, pre-ordered. And there were great expectations that it would really make a difference very fast. And then the AstraZeneca company had to tell the EU that, unfortunately, they were not able to provide even nearly as much as they had promised in the first quarter. And this, of course, happened in a situation where everyone is, fatigued, just exhausted by all this lockdown thing, and politicians, of course, desperate to get us out of it. Economies on their knees everywhere, and so it was a great disappointment, following great expectations. And then, of course, there was a public confrontation between the two. And from what I understand, AstraZeneca will now try to provide more than they said they could. some rich countries would say, why didn't we go it alone? Of course, we could have done that. Germany and France would then probably have gotten vaccines before Bulgaria, probably before Norway, probably before small countries without big purchasing power or big population. And I think that would have been short-sighted in a continent where we're supposed to have open borders between us. There's a common work market. And I think it would have meant close borders and economies that would have been subdued for a long, long time. In addition, of course, to the anger it would have produced between us.
And I think part of the argument, at least, you know, that one might read in the news for going it alone is the idea that some countries might have pumped in a lot of money into the development phase of a vaccine. Can you talk about the role of public money in what is essentially in some ways a very, you know, an endeavor by private pharmaceutical companies? So how do the public and the private kind of meet in these spaces?
Well, vaccines in particular need public funding to be made, to be researched and developed and made, especially at this point. But because it's so obscure, there's very, very little transparency in what exactly companies get from public sources over time in order to develop vaccines. Because as we said before, it takes a long time. It builds on knowledge that is there before, and who knows where the money came from what. And there is very little transparency in this. So we don't know exactly, you know, the number of the figure. But we do know that there is massive public funding in the vaccines that we are waiting for and getting now. And that, of course, makes the case for also why should this be a private property that would profit private interests when it is publicly funded.
You know, when you talk about Europe acting as a one agent when it comes to purchasing vaccines, that's nice, but I think it also raises the question for people from other countries who might have to wait much longer in line for their own vaccines. And with the idea of a global pandemic like COVID-19, there's this idea that floats around a lot, which is that we're not safe until all of us are safe. So I'd like to understand a bit more from you. What are the implications for not being able to give everyone the same level of attention, or how do you see this unfolding?
Well, it is quite stark to, as it was said in this country just the other day, probably all 18-year-olds in Norway will be vaccinated before most health workers in Africa. And this may be the case. But the world is so interconnected, and the virus has shown us this, how it travels. And we also see that virus mutate in situations where it can roam. This is a normal thing, but we will have new mutants that may be more aggressive, and maybe some that the vaccines that are developed don't work on. And that might put even the vaccinated populations back to square one if that is allowed to go on. So even from a selfish point of view in a rich country, it doesn't make sense to not think of everybody else.
Thank you, Ingeborg, for speaking with us about this topic today.
Thank you, Sindhu. Thank you.
You can read more about our investigation into vaccine nationalism by visiting our website, which is investigate-europe.eu, where we also have explainers and interview materials on the topic. And if you would like to support the independent journalism that's done by our cross-border collective, please consider leaving a monthly donation by clicking on the donate button on our homepage. Thank you, and see you next time.